or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nimco.
Well, tomorrow's Labor Day, and normally when I do my Labor Day show, I make some encomium to the worker. But today, you know, most times people take, Labor Day's day, you take a day off to, you know, give yourself a rest from your toils. Well, unfortunately, these days with so many people out of work, there's no day to take off from. So I'll simply say, here's to all of you who have indeed quietly, without any real recognition, make this country go, as well as the people who wish they could become part of the world that makes something, makes the nation go. And I hope for better times. I don't know what to say. I want to say one little thing. You know, it's a sad thing about the zeitgeist of the era that in the old days, you could at least reasonably hope that if you submitted an application for a job, some employer placed an ad, and you answered an ad for which you were truly well qualified, and you know you did demonstrate that you had the qualifications, there was a reasonable chance you sent that up enough applications you can get a job. But with good jobs, at least good jobs so scarce, that rarely does it anymore. Alas. And it is truly a decrement to society that it is as much a matter today of who you know as what you know. So much as I hate to encourage that, but as an advocate for you, my listeners, some of whom are looking for work, I do invite you to think about, at least, casting aside any aversion you have to that schmoozing, to that networking, and realize that for survival, unless you're a superstar, you really do need to use your existing network, build on your existing network. You still can remain ethical. You don't need to exaggerate what you can bring to the table. But I think you do need, these days, I guess it does take a village. A little Labor Day thought on perhaps the most sober of the Labor Days I've had in the 24 years I've been hosting this show. Now, I want to turn to a much more pleasant task. One of my recreations, because I spend a lot of time in the car, is listening to CDs on, there's courses on CD from a company called The Teaching Company. And what The Teaching Company does is they scour the nation's universities to find truly top award-winning, teaching award-winning professors, not research award-winning professors, but teaching award-winning professors. And then they have them teach like compressed courses and make them available on CD. And I've taken probably a half dozen. But recently, I took my very favorite. I've never before asked one of the teachers of the courses to come on the show, but this time I'm making an exception. His name is Arnold Weinstein. Let me tell you a little bit about him. He was born in a most unlikely place for me to be inviting somebody on the show, and it is Memphis, Tennessee. And then, very kind of anomalous, I don't think of many people from Memphis going to Princeton, but an early sign of his exceptionality. Went to Princeton, then Harvard for a PhD in Comp Lit, comparative literature. And from there, unlike so many of us job hoppers, he has spent his entire career at Brown as a professor. Lived also a bit, but lest you think he spent the entire time sequestered in his ivory tower, he's lived a good bit in France and Sweden, taught in both places, and been teaching courses for The Teaching Company for two decades now. Publisher, he's written 8 books, 5 with University Presses, 3 with Random House, and this latest one, which is called Morning, Noon, and Night. Why don't I have the subtitle here? But it's about the lessons of life, lessons from, all stages of life, lessons from literature of all stages of life. Anyway, this book has been nominated just for a Pulitzer Prize. So it is a particular pleasure to welcome to the show Arnold Weinstein.
Delighted to be here, Marty.
Good. And I think I already pronounced it wrong. It's Weinstein, right?
That's right, but I answered to both.
Yeah, right. And so give me the subtitle correctly. What's the subtitle of the book?
Finding the Meaning of Life Stages through books.
Excellent. All right. Well, you know, he and I had this little, more than little exchange, and one of the things that that you wrote in one of our exchanges was, quote, "All too often, literature takes a rather critical view of work as either numbing or empty or exploitative," end quote. Why do you say all too often?
Because it's got to be a reductive picture of work. That's partly because literature is drawn to problems rather than to successes. Somebody once said that happy love has no history, that people don't write about satisfactions as much as they write about trouble. But it's also, I think, the case that work itself is a far more complex issue, creature, entity, than writers frequently assume. And some of the most interesting writing does get into it and helps us, I think, enrich our view of what work itself is. So all too often means that frequently it's simply shrugged off as routine or deadening. But the best literature, I think, takes a more generous and a more insightful view.
Yeah, we'll take a look at that. But, you know, when I look at the, you know, it was Freud who said that the two most important things in life are work and love. I would dare say that, you know, you're the literature expert, not me. But in general, love is given a far more sympathetic view than work. Why do you think that is? Or first of all, am I correct? And if so, why?
You are correct, it seems to me, too, that somehow one sets the heart beating a little faster than the other. One is thought to be more practical. You need to do it. And, you know, different cultures have different views. We work to live frequently, or we live to work. And there's a sense in which, for example, in France, I think work does not have the same kind of, let's say, existential meaning that it often does for Americans. I think we endow work with a kind of value that other cultures perhaps are, you know, a little more reluctant to do.
You know, I want to present an alternative view, Arnold. It's my view that the pool of people who have chosen a life of writing, of literature, are people who deliberately are the people who eschew the kind of mainstream world of work and almost seen as looked down upon it. And so they, in some sense, consciously or unconsciously, you know, want to kind of dismiss the importance of the machinist or the lawyer or anything in between. And so I think that creates you have a kind of a very biased group of folks writing about work. You buy that?
No, I mean, I buy it in part because it certainly has its share of the truth. But first of all, writing itself is work. And writers work. You know, there's the famous story of Hemingway, who set himself X number of hours every day to write one true sentence and essentially blew his brains out when he found that, you know, first of all, there may be no true sentences, but you can't always do that. But there's a lot of labor in writing. And I think that, again, substantial first-rate literature is rarely that dismissive. Now, about professors, you know, that's a little tricky. It is true, I think, the universities are places where people come to hide often in life, that they, but there, too, they work, and they have to get tenure, and they have a salary, and they have families, and they have the same kinds of challenges and routines that other people do. So I guess I'm not quite as negative as you are about the image produced of work at the university.
Yeah, I wouldn't argue that people work hard at universities or as writers. It's just that they tend to have, in my mind, an unnecessary and inappropriately elitist view about work that is, quote, lesser than being a writer.
Well, I regret that I think you may be right. I think that there is a kind of large, you know, scale truth in that. There is a kind of elitism in literature and art. But, you know, that's with us. It goes way back about the value of spirit as opposed to anything else. And these are the spiritual vocations as opposed to the practical ones. So, I mean, it has its own legacy, its own history, it seems to me.
You know, it's so odd that, as you and I both know, so many professors spend their lives really counting the number of angels on a head of a pin, accomplishing really nothing for the world, just getting published in another little journal, whereas somebody who is the most, you know, the ditch digger is accomplishing something of, you know, in a cosmic sense, greater value. And so it seems just cosmically unjust that, for professors and indeed even auteurs to deign themselves superior to those who are actually making perhaps an arguably bigger difference in the cosmos.
Well, it's hard to gauge, you know, who really is impacting the cosmos. I think that ditch diggers do. I would agree, by the way, with your assessment about much of the scholarly writing, which is counting the angels that dance on a pinhead. But I don't think that's true of college teaching, at least when it's any good. I don't think it's true of most of the teaching company courses.
Right.
I think that they're aiming at the imagination of readers, and I think that that is a kind of universal quality that exists beyond work. It also exists within one's work. And so to help people to lead, let's say, a more imaginative, fulfilling, even exploratory life, that has its own practicality, it seems to me. That makes life also richer. I don't know if it makes the cosmos improved, but I do think that imagination is sort of the touchstone of literature and art, and that good teaching has to be allied to it because that's what you want to sort of touch or wake up among your students.
I couldn't agree more. It's a good time for me to remind our listeners, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is nominee for Pulitzer Prize for his latest book, Morning, Noon, and Night. And I still don't have the subtitle in front of me, so it's you tell us the subtitle again?
Finding the Meaning of Life Stages Through Books.
Right. Okay. Now, much earlier you said something, you said that the really good literati do not give short shrift to work. Give me an example.
Well, you know, one example, for example, is the writer Kierkegaard. I'm going to quote you a little piece here that I think gets to this. Kierkegaard mentions the old phrase, only one who works gets bread. And then he points out that this is not true often in the real world. There are many people who get bread and don't work, so they inherit the bread. There are many people who work very hard and don't get their bread. But then he goes on, and I'm going to quote him here, about how different things are in the world of the spirit. He said, here in the spirit, there prevails an eternal divine order. Here it does not rain on the just and the unjust alike. Here the sun does not shine on both good and evil. Here, in the spirit, only one who works gets bread. Only one who knows anguish finds rest. Only one who descends to the underworld saves the loved one. He's thinking about Orpheus and Eurydice. And then only one who draws the knife gets Isaac. He's thinking about Abraham and Isaac. And what I think he's making there is a statement about labor itself, that the reward we get is only a reward because we have toiled, we have worked, we've labored for it. I also think that his remark really characterizes the challenge of understanding, that we have to work to understand our loved ones. We have to work to understand our environment. We have to work if we're looking at a painting or a film or just looking at the scene that takes place on the street in front of us. So labor is more, it seems to me, than just, let's say, the job that you're paid for or the job that you're looking to get. And in that sense, I think Kierkegaard and many other writers, you know, they shine a beam on that. They tell us something about it.
That is very interesting. I think especially for the many hedonists among us here in California, land of hedonism, that probably rankles and, you know, and it's easily dismissed as some puritanical, Calvinist kind of thinking. But I had not thought about that. But
And about hedonism, the word that's used incessantly at Brown is by the students is, what's the workload of this course? And when my students ask me that, I tell them, this isn't a workload. You're going to be reading novels and poems this semester. That's fun. Let's don't think about that as just work. Now, what I just said, too, is that fun becomes more interesting when we labor, when we toil. That's how we convert surfaces into depth or facts into meaning.
You know, I think that's such a great point. Now, perhaps just because it vindicates the way in which I live my life, I work constantly. I am a crazy person who literally works from 8:30 in the morning till midnight every day. And it is the act of the labor, the fact that I am laboring, whether it is I am writing or I am exercising or I am really focusing intently on one of my career counseling clients, that feels not pleasurable, but feels right. It feels more rewarding than if it was just fun. Interesting point.
Yeah, in one of the Brown buildings, one of the engineering buildings, has a picture of a human brain next to a bicycle, and it says, take it out for a ride. It's when you use your brain and use your intelligence and use all of the equipment that you have that it's inherently gratifying. It can be exhausting, but it's also gratifying. That's the stuff that you've got.
Exactly. And that's when you do lose time. That's when you have the sense of flow. Yes, if it's too difficult, if it really is beyond you, then hard work is probably not worth it. But if it is within your ken, within your skill set, to abilities to do something, working until you're tired, is somehow doesn't make you happier, but makes this quiet contentment of feeling worthwhile.
And, you know, a skill set can almost be thought of as an organic thing that is capable of growth, too. There was a fascinating piece in the Times today saying that they surveyed many, many, many workers, and we're talking about the employed, not the unemployed, who said that over a third of them said that they were disenchanted or bored or unmotivated or outright depressed with their work. And the reason that the article suggested, that the researcher suggested, is that they get no endorsement for their work. No one has tried to tell them that they're achieving something, that there's meaning in their work, or, and the other word used, that they're making progress in their work. So that work itself, you know, has a kind of life. It has a lifeline, but it also has a kind of potential development in it. And if, I think that many workers, if they could see it that way, that this has a kind of futurity, this goes somewhere, this can develop, this can be more next week or next year than it is today, they're arguing that that not only makes for happier workers, but they also say productivity is key to that, that's how we get a more productive labor force too.
Here's how I would make people feel better about their work. First of all, it would seem to me, first of all, externally, people, we pathologize hard workers. We don't call them hard workers, great contributors to society. We pathologize them with the term we normally use for alcoholics, and we call them workaholics. There is something, it is seeming unseemly, and you who comes from the South originally, it's something unseemly to be seen as somebody who works too hard. We need to revere, we need to honor them more than pathologize them. And in the absence of that, because we're not going to change society right away, we all cannot rely on externalities. We cannot rely on others to go and make us feel good about our work life. We need to feel better about our being productive in and unto itself, even if we are a dishwasher. And the final thing I want to say, and then I want to get your reaction, is many times people feel more worthy about their work life when their bosses praise them. They don't stop to think about the following. It is actually pragmatic for bosses not to praise workers much, because disproportionately what happens is then the worker feels either more complacent and not worse. Say, oh, good, my boss doesn't, you know, unlike intrinsically motivated people like you or I, they say, oh, good, now I'm doing fine, I can work less, or they're going to ask for a raise. So many bosses deliberately withhold praise. What do you think about my little brain dump there?
Well, I think prior to reading this article today, I would have tended to agree with you. The article really does suggest, and this is all, you know, derived from the accounts offered by the workers, is that the absence of praise or the absence of a kind of endorsement on the part of the managerial component, you know, of their job, does have a real detrimental effect. Now, obviously, there has to be a risk that people could become complacent. I think it's, you know, I don't know that it's all one or all the other, and I think it's not easy for everyone to find entirely within themselves motivation. It helps to be massaged a little bit.
Sure.
It helps to be, put it like this, it helps to be recognized, to be, in a sense, it endorses you, and I think it even energizes you. It says, yes, you're going to do more of this.
Yeah, I understand that too. Let's turn to, you know, for me, when I think about literature that deals with work, although I first saw this, The Death of a Salesman, 20, 30, 40 years ago, I can't get it out of my mind. To me, it is the most potent indictment of the American way of working, of capitalism. What would you like to say about the salesman?
Well, it is that. I mean, you know, Miller once said that pathos came too easily to him, that it's a heartbreaking play.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's one of the issues it has is exploitation. You know, there's a famous sort of footnote that at one performance in the early days of it, some magnate walked up to the stage and explained that he was going to improve the retirement benefits for his workers. Mm-hmm. So exploitation is a piece of it, which is what happens to Willie Loman. Mm-hmm. But I think the deeper piece of it that's even more disturbing is obsolescence, that you mm-hmm. find one day that you can't keep up, or that what you can do is no longer adequate to the needs of your job, or you're simply moving into, you know, into entropy, that you no longer have the same skill or the same can-do that you had when you started. And I think that that's simply the treadmill of time. And mm-hmm. I believe that that is a real issue with work. And, of course, it depends on the kind of work you do. There's some kinds of physical labor this sets in even earlier, that you simply can't do the same kind of hard labor. But it's equally true, it seems to me, intellectually, that there's some kinds of reasonings, or there's some kinds of formulas that you have to be able to produce, or let's put it like this, the technology changes so fast that you haven't been able to keep up with it. So all of this has a potentially tragic dimension too.
Mm-hmm.
But about Death of a Salesman, mm-hmm. Willie Loman loved his work. That's one of the sweet things about the play.
Mm-hmm.
He was a happy salesman. And in a sense, the play sort of really respects the dignity and joy of work, and it talks about this other worker, Dave Singelman, whose funeral was attended by hundreds of people, so that it almost marks a kind of nostalgic view that there was a time when the culture at large really valued labor, perhaps, in a way that it doesn't as much today.
Yeah, a couple of things. I think I remember that Dave Singelman quote. He was saying, I remember that Dave Singelman, and he would go and he'd pound the pavement for, 43 states, and he'd sit there in his green gray velvet smoking jacket, and he'd call people, and they'd all be glad to see him and all that stuff. But he would then go in there from there to the very next paragraph or the next same saying, I hate it. I don't know what I was meant to do. I think he was tortured about the ambivalence of it all. Does that make sense?
Yes, and also tortured by being, I think, sort of translated almost like a mathematical equation into output. In other words, he can't cut the mustard. He can no longer deliver. He can no longer produce as he did in his best days.
Yeah.
And the company uses this kind of brutal logic that says, you can't produce, out with you.
Exactly.
And that's, the wife, Linda, says, this is tragic. You can't use a man like this, and then towards the end of his career, just toss him out.
Exactly. She says, attention must be paid.
That's right.
And
what a great phrase, yes.
Yeah, you used a couple of terms in describing, you said, the treadmill. You use the term entropy. The phrase I like to use is we're more on a conveyor belt. We are on this conveyor belt where we are ever closer to the end. And maybe you're wrong. Maybe I don't know what. Maybe none of those are right, metaphors are right. But this notion of obsolescence, of entropy. What does literature say? Many of the listeners to the show are in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and they are feeling, like you said, either lack of the technology. They can't keep up technologically. Their mind is not quick enough to keep learning endlessly. They can't. They get tired faster. They forget more. All of those things. Does literature have any reassurance, any kind of and not even reassurance, any words that are wise to keep in mind for those folks, other than forget it, hang it up, boy, the party's over?
Well, the traditional societies in the old days revered the old. They revered the elders. The elders were thought of as the repository of wisdom. In America, which is such a youth-oriented culture, which is, of course, in keeping with the technologically-oriented culture, that whole notion is kaput. It doesn't work anymore. So I think that as we age, and American society is not kind to people who age. And I think that they can no longer meet the demands that are put on them. But the challenge is to see that perhaps there is a kind of maturity or wisdom or harmony or understanding or fullness that comes with getting older. It may not translate into being as effective on the job as you were. I don't know how anybody can really sort of meet that criticism, because it's there. But I think life, again, is more than just the job. If as a grandparent, you understand and value your children and your grandchildren and see something about, the fullness of life in them and therefore the fullness of your own life. I mean, there's certain things you cannot see when you're young. You may be very effective in your work, but you don't have the same overview of your life. You can't see the curve of your life, of your relationships. So that there's a sense that perhaps morally or spiritually or emotionally, these are maybe the area, even imaginatively, the areas where one keeps growing. I mean, I really tried to wrestle with that in this book, that as you move towards the end, as you decline in some ways, is there growth in other ways? We use that phrase, to grow old. Well, what kind of growth is this? It has to be more than just senility or getting weaker, and so therefore it should be moral or spiritual or, emotional or imaginative. Those are the areas, it seems to me, where growth is still possible, right up to the end.
You talked about the possibility of gaining more wisdom. Neil Simon said something once that really soured me. He said, I think he said this in his play Broadway Bound. He said, wisdom does not come with age. Wisdom comes with wisdom. Sometimes people get, they can get older, not any wiser. But I want to share with you mine, if you share with me yours. I'm 61. And I am grateful that I still have good energy and my mind is pretty much as good as it's been. But I also am aware of being on the conveyor belt. I'm aware that, this next decade is probably my best good one. And here's how I try to deal with it psychologically. And you're also, you've got a few years on you. I want to hear how you deal with it. How I deal with it is this. I feel like, although I'll always be a type A intense guy till the day I die, I do feel I can be a little more reflective now. I have a sense of perspective about what matters and what doesn't. When I was a teenager, I was a shoplifter. I had no values at all. All I cared about was expediency. But little by little, I have gained a sense of what is more important. So I can take some solace in that. Even no matter how old I get, I feel I will have that additional sense of perspective. Finally, the other thing is that I do tend to view everything in terms of the largest good, because I'm an atheist. When I go, the worm's going to eat me up, the party's over. So I only think, I'm thinking constantly about in every moment, including on this show, how can I do the most cosmic good? I don't think you can do that when you're 20. That's how I deal with feeling like I'm not getting older, I'm getting better. How do you deal with it, if at all?
Well, since I am out of that last good decade that you're just
oh, geez.
Since I'm 10 years older, you know, I'm looking back at the party. Mm. My mother used to always say, every decade has its own goodness, and that the wisdom consists of figuring out what it is. I'm still working on that. I'm not quite sure what the 70s are going to be good for. Nonetheless, I'm in them, and the alternatives of not being in them are even worse. So what, who knows how evolved you may be in 10 years? You may find that you can do much more for the world in 10 years. I mean, doing more for the world, again, is an imaginative and emotional proposition. It's not just a question of producing things. And so one hopes that one, continues to mature, continues to understand. I find that to be a terrible challenge because I know that I'm, as someone who doesn't have the same energy that I had when I was your young 61, I find that what do I, sort of match that with? If I don't have that energy, what do I have more of aside mm-hmm. from more problems? And I think about, I'd like to be more understanding. I think that teaching the young, which is the great privilege of in my mm-hmm. job, mm-hmm. is every year they're the same age. Mm-hmm. Of course, I'm not, but every mm-hmm. year, so that sort of pact or covenant, with young people is extraordinarily lucky. I mean, it not that it keeps me young, but it keeps me aware of the young. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the problems often in careers is that you really lose track of the younger generations.
Let me ask you, I'm going to take a side path with your permission here. It's very interesting to me. I'm a career counselor. That's what I do during the week all the time. And, you're a guy, I like you immensely. I just think you're terrific. So I'm excited at the prospect of spending the next few minutes on this radio show with you, with your permission, seeing if we can figure out, in your 70s, how you can be a better teacher in your 70s, different teacher, let's call you a different teacher, that is invaluable to your students, how we can make you an even more invaluable teacher to your students because you are in your 70s. And then secondarily, what you could write. We talked off the air a little bit about a book you might want to write next. What would be a book that only because you're in your 70s makes you almost quintessentially qualified to write the book? Are you willing to go down those two paths with me for a little while?
I'll try, but I'm going to be listening more than talking, but hoping that you're going to give me some answers for all of this.
Well, I'm going to start by listening first. So, okay. So
again, I'm very lucky. It's not like I have to lift weights or anything, that I go and I speak to my students about literature and about art and about the range of issues that we're talking about today. That is not on a treadmill or on a conveyor belt. So therefore, you use the word reflective. You think that you're a lot more reflective than you were in your 20s. And I think that has a kind of endless upside, reflection, it also can be paralyzing. You can be so reflective that you can't move.
Analysis paralysis.
That's right. But on the other hand, I think that in teaching, it's an invaluable trump card. That is to say that because frequently students who are also in their late teens and early 20s are not reflective. They read a poem or they read a novel, and it never really occurs to them that this is also about their own lives, or this is about issues that they will either have to deal with or have dealt with without dealing with them, that they've run into them and never paid attention. So I think that as I get older, I can become wiser about those matters. I can become better at helping students to see the kind of human dimensions of what it is they're reading. And I think that's one of the great, great, great challenges and often one of the great failures of education, which is that students are bored. And
yes.
They're bored because either on their own or with their teachers, it never really dawns on them that the things they're encountering are exciting, meaningful, and also germane. They apply to their own lives. And I think that's what teaching needs to do, and I look forward to that in the continuing years that I do teach.
Good. All right, so now what I'm going to, in light of what you said, plus adding a couple of little ideas in my head, I'm going to make a very specific proposal for what you should do, and you tell me what you like and don't like about it. I, as a little prefatory material, I believe that one of the reasons students are so bored is what I call the tyranny of content. Professors, perhaps in an attempt to cram in as much as possible or to impress their fellow professors or their own sense for desire for rigor, they make students read too much. I'm inviting you to teach a course based on one book, where the entire course was one book, one piece of literature, that would be, as you were saying, something that would enable an 18 to 20-year-old to gain more perspective. It's almost like an instant Ertnog of, you know, distillation of everything about that's needed to get perspective. What, as a first step in this, what would be the one book that you, from all those that you love, it's got to be something you love, or maybe even something you've never even read, maybe this is a time to do something new rather than revisiting. What would be one book that you have a sense would be transform, help those 18 to 20-year-olds gain more perspective and help you grow as well?
Well, it has to be a book that's got a lot of, you know, mileage in it so that they can continue to work with it during mm-hmm. 12 or 13 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one could imagine doing War and Peace. It has to be a long book. Proust is one of the writers whom I do teach, and I have them read some maybe 1,500 pages over the course of a semester.
Of Remembrance, yeah.
More. Mm-hmm. Joyce's Ulysses is a very rewarding book, except most people find it so difficult that they won't plunge in. Here's also what you're up against, because, and I think it's implied in the way you presented this, the tyranny of content.
Mm-hmm.
The students are taking courses as if they had a rifle or a gun barrel that they're going to put notches on about how many books they have read. Okay, they've disposed of that. Now it's done. On to the next one. It's very arduous to make students understand, okay, you've read it. Now let's think about it. Or what about something really, really heretical? Why don't you reread it? I mean, certainly, you don't think you understand a Picasso painting the first time you glance at it.
Exactly.
And you don't understand a difficult work of fiction. You don't understand your partner in life the first time you meet them. And so art also, literature, et cetera, deserves, you know, a slower approach, just like they talk about, you know, slow food instead of fast food. It's a much more gratifying type of activity. And but we're running up against a culture that values speed, that values getting as much done, bottom line thinking as they can, and that's a hard act. Also, if you've got 12 or 13 weeks, which is what our calendar gives us, you've got to choose a book there that can sustain people's interest for that long.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt you. So I'm going to make a proposal in light of what you just said. I believe you should teach Ulysses, mm-hmm. and they should read it twice in the course of the semester, and here's why. I think that the students who go to elite, highly selective universities are indeed poisoned by the youth culture desire for quantity, speed, etc. And therefore, your one course could be at least a slightly leavening effect for that, and you would sell it as that. And you would, just as you articulately and beautifully explained to me the value of that, that's how you'd get them to buy it. Now, why Ulysses? Because Ulysses also is an antidote to the linear, rational thinking. Everything is a completely coherent story. The randomness of the various thoughts, the way in which we really in life think, which is not linear and sequential, but very often off on these little seemingly random side paths, and that it is not wise, as the main character says, to face all your problems, but it's wise to skirt your problems, would be an excellent antidote to what the messages will otherwise get you by then.
I do buy it. I think that you, and even at a young 61, you can see the wisdom of that perspective or that posture even,
mm-hmm.
that ducking things sometimes is smarter than tackling them, mm-hmm. or going head-on into them in collision.
Like health issues, right.
But I also think that that it's there, too. You know, we run into a deep-seated view of progress that the young people have. No, I mean, I've taught at Brown long enough. It's one of the few, you know, rewards of being at a place as many decades as I have. That I have a reputation, students would probably take a course like that. They would. One of the challenges that I have is that I want them to get some exposure to, you know, a range of things. I'm only going to get them for that semester. But no, that would, you know, I'm going to bear it in mind. I'm taking notes as you're talking to me. That would be a possible course, and people would take it. Part of the problem of Ulysses is the way, it's what you said, which is that Joyce writes it the way the mind thinks, which is not linear. You know, we live life forward, but we make sense of things backward. We make sense of things in retrospect. I mean, just like, you know, we write our resumes. We don't live that way. You don't know at 6 that you're going to, you didn't know at 22 with the career you just mentioned a few minutes ago what you were going to be doing today. So it all looks so much more cogent in the traditional way, and it's very, I think, sort of exciting to realize that, no, it comes with spurts and starts, and we travel back, you know, to make sense of things that happened earlier, and the idea of sort of one clear, continuous path ahead is really a fantasy. It's not true.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Pulitzer Prize nominee Arnold Weinstein. He is a Brown Professor of Comparative Literature, and the latest book that he, the book that is the Pulitzer Prize nominee, is nominating book is Morning, Noon, and Night: Finding the Meaning of Life in All Stages of Life Through Literature. Now, I promised you that, so that's just one thought, and it does, you can plug in some other book other than Ulysses, but I like to think that that freedom from the tyranny of content will also be a relief. I know as a student, if I'm told that I only have to read one book, I'm going to read it a lot more carefully.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to read the Cliff Notes. I'm going to say, okay, maybe I can savor this. And I believe that when day is done, I'm going to have grown far more from savoring, even if, dare I say, a short book. But if I really pored over that short book, if we look to, you know, you love Virginia Woolf, you did To the Lighthouse. If you took To the Lighthouse and really took it apart sentence by sentence, idea by idea, embedded idea and embedded idea, I would bet that your students would grow more from all the survey literature courses around. Do you buy that or not really?
I do buy it entirely. And the Cliff Notes or Wikipedia, all of that is, of course, you know, it's reductive, it's fact-driven, and it has nothing to do with the actual meaning of these materials. And that would be a very, you know, gratifying and useful type of experience.
An experiment.
So I may try that out, but it's a, again, as I say, the culture itself seems to be going in a different direction, and the students themselves are beset with this idea of, they always ask me, Mr. Professor Weinstein, tell me the 50 or 100 books that I have to read. They do not say, tell me the book that I could read and reread and reread and learn more and more from.
And Arnold Weinstein, your job is not to support necessarily the dominating culture. One of the purposes of, certainly of tenure, and the fact that you've been around for a million years and not getting rid of you, you have the right to say, this is what I think is right for my students. The zeitgeist be damned. Does that not make sense?
It does make sense. But again, part of the war is with me. Mm-hmm. I like, in the course where I read a lot of Proust, I also read Joyce, where they read Ulysses, but they only read it for 4 weeks instead of for 12. But we also read three of Faulkner's novels, who's one of my favorites. That's the Memphis side mm-hmm. of me that comes into the equation.
Yeah, well, it may be that I'm asking you now, instead of being, to look at not what's best. I would argue that if you picked a book that you would love to pore over in great detail, that is, you're not bored because you have taught a million of these books, many of these books so many times, but if you were to pick a book that you yourself would grow from poring over it in great detail, even if it was a 200-page book, but that would also be tremendously valuable to your students, I think that would satisfy you as well as your their students, as well as the what's right for the cosmos.
No, I think we see eye to eye on that.
Let's go to the second part of what we said the side path was going to be, which is your next book.
Okay.
What's a book we talked off? Can I tell?
You're going to tell me what it should be.
I will. I will at least gently suggest what it might be. But off the air, we talked about the idea that you might want to write a book about the city or about agency, something related to that. So we'll put that aside for the moment. Let's play afresh, something that you hadn't thought of before. So if I pose this question to you and I simply said, what is a book that you could be motivated to and able to write and write well, that you can write in your 70s that you couldn't write as well in your 60s, 50s, 40s, or 30s? What might it be?
Now, you're stumping me. Partly because this last one, about which deals so much with getting older, mm-hmm. is so dead on about where I find myself in life now.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in a sense, I excavated a good bit of my brain and heart in that book and put it in there. The reason that I mentioned the city is that it has a lot of issues that that have not been sort of front and center in other books that I've written. I do think, you know, as we you said off air, we did talk about the issue of agency, which is a kind of central issue, it seems to me, because I think that young people have an almost religious sense of their own agency. Mm-hmm. It's what the culture says: you're born, you can do what you want, you're a free agent, you've got upward mobility, et cetera. And I think that, by the way, it's an American concept. In Europe, people are not born into that kind of model. But I think that life itself chastens us a little bit, human relations do. So I think as I get older, I think I become more knowledgeable about that issue, about the beauty of agency, the notion of self-empowerment, and at the same time, the range of things that complicate it, but also enrich it, to make it so that we don't just go through on our own solo trip, but that we are bouncing into or taking in or breathing in the life and values of other people as well.
So if I said, great, so we don't need a new topic, what we need is a distillation. So just like Morning, Noon, and Night talked about what literature has to offer in all stages of life, what if you were to talk, if the book was called Control, and it was, or agent, you know, because agency is a little bit of an esoteric term, mm-hmm. Control. When you have it and when you don't, making the most of life or something like that, but where it looked at both sides of the issue of individual agency. What's your reaction to that?
Well, that's not a bad idea. I mean, it control has implications of, you know, of police and this mm-hmm, and the mm-hmm, other, mm-hmm. which makes it tricky, I think.
Right.
But one thing that would have to be at the core of any book that I wrote would be using literary materials. And it makes mm-hmm. me sound like a guy, you know, who is sort of using a crutch. But I find that in writing about literature, it frees me to understand life itself. So that it's the material. There's a great comment that I heard from somebody else once. This woman was asked, how well do you know Shakespeare? And her answer was, not as well as he knows me. Hmm. And I think that writing helps me to understand the issues that I want to talk about and helps me to understand myself. Those things would go into a book at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So I would probably have a more complicated picture of control, about its limits, about the fantasy of control, about our perhaps needing to get a little bit free and clear that we can control things. I mean, mm-hmm. we're born into a body that we didn't control. When we get sick, we didn't control it. A lot of the somatic issues in life are certainly beyond our control, even though we can work out and, you know, Americans seem to think that if they just follow the right regime, they're going to be immortal. But it just doesn't work that way.
Hey, now I want to come up with draft two of this idea for the book. So it is about agency, and the way it's divided is 30 characters in literature who are exemplars, you know, of some aspect of this control issue. Maybe one that really was, you know, like the Horatio Alger and pretty much can control their own environment. And on the other extreme, the true marionette, somebody who was really buffeted by the winds of fate despite all of their best efforts. Mm-hmm. And maybe drawing them, you know, all 30 chapters across a continuum from the most in control to the least. What do you think about that as a concept?
Well, I think that many, many great literature texts, I mean, the Oedipus is about exactly that. The guy thinks he's in control.
Mm-hmm.
Turns
mm-hmm.
out he doesn't know who's sharing his bed, and he doesn't know who the guy was that he killed at the crossroads.
Mm.
So frequently it's the same person who thinks they're in control, and one fine day the curtain goes up and he realizes, oops, you know, nothing worked out the way I thought it did.
Mm-hmm.
But you think of a book like The Great Gatsby, which is certainly a tribute to the American sort of power of creation and of control and of agency and of making your life into the figure that you want. And of course he comes undone at the end, but there's something very beautiful in that force of desire that you know, that animates Gatsby. Or you think of a story like Kafka's Metamorphosis. You wake up one day and you're transformed into an insect. Bye-bye control, you know, that and I think if the day that somebody has a stroke or whatever else, I think that they realize that control is something that is great in your salad days, when everything works, and perhaps, you know, it takes a few bumps later.
But I would caution you against, because if you wrote a book only of people who was, you know, the illusion of control and then they're not control, I think that's probably not, you know, that is a very tempting, you know, structure to focus on all those. And most people may be like that. But there are some people who manage in real life to retain a remarkable amount of control and do a remarkable amount of things in the face of all kinds of external problems, and then others who are on the other extreme. So I think the book would be most interesting if it covered the full range of those. Does that make sense?
I agree with you, and I think that certainly control is also a way of focusing human energy, and it's a question also of seeing what you can and what you can't, control, et cetera. So all of that would go into a book like that. As I say, I'm taking notes. We'll be in touch on that one later.
So let's before we go back to the core part of our discussion, why don't you summarize what, and no BS now, honestly, what would you say you really got, whether in terms of for either of those two things we talked about, planning a course or writing the book, what have you gotten from our conversation about this?
Well, I've gotten a kind of, I think, core optimism in your view of life, which is that you have a can-do picture of things, and you also have a sense that this can lead to public good. And I share that. I think as someone who's a decade older, I'm more, you know, I'm more chastened about the liabilities involved in it. But I've got that you've been inspiriting in that way. Because I am serious when I say I'll reflect on these matters and see if I might. Heaven knows I need to write another book because it helps me know who I am.
Right.
It's a way that, you know, it's like, again, you've got a brain. Why don't you take it out for a spin?
Right, right. And I would invite you at any point when you've gotten some greater clarity on both the next book and the course. You know, most of the show or half of the show is normally a call-in segment. I'm dispensing with that because I love talking with you, Arnold. But I would invite you to call at any point to just report back to our dear listeners. You know, what you've ended up doing with regard to both of those ideas. So feel free to do that. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is the nominee or a nominee for the Pulitzer Prize for his new book, Morning, Noon, and Night, Finding the Meaning of Life in All Stages of Life Through Literature. And so now, sometimes our lives are changed not by a whole book, but by snippets, by a sentence, by an image, by a scene. Can you tell us about one or more snippets from the hundreds of books you've read and reread that continue to pop into your brain, informing the way you live your life, perhaps even especially your work life?
Well, I'll tell you one. It's a couple of lines from a poem by William Blake, and it strikes me as terribly modern, even though it was written in the 1790s.
Mm-hmm.
It goes like this: in every cry of every man, in every infant's cry of fear, in every voice, in every band, here comes the clincher, the mind-forged manacles I hear. And Blake is writing, as I say, about the poem is called London, and mind-forged manacles is the single most potent expression I have ever seen for police work that doesn't require the police, that it's about repression, that we forge our own manacles. We are imprisoned through our own belief in external coercion or constraint. Now, this goes along with your idea of control, that if we wanted enough, desired enough, or could see enough, we could get clear of some of this. I think Blake's view is that culture is a system that coerces us.
Right.
But the worst is that it doesn't require armed agents out there doing it. We breathe it in. It's like pollution, that the smoke that comes out of the exhaust pipe is in your lungs. It's not out there only. And I think that, therefore, there's a lot of, I think, political punch in those lines. And I think the interesting thing about literature, again, is that you've got to be reflective, that lines like that just jump out at you. Another line that jumps out at me, it's one that everybody...
Before we get to the next line, I want to comment on that very important first line. I mean, absolutely, especially, I guess maybe in all eras, there are orthodoxies. We tend to view things because we are lemmings as a society. We find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't. So there tends to be groupthink and lemmingthink, and I think that's a very, very important point, especially maybe here in the Bay Area, where we do seem to feel like we have a monopoly on good ideas, and maybe at Brown as well, where they're, frankly, where the left feels that all ideas reside left of center. Is that a fair inference?
It's a fair enough inference. One of the sweet things about those lines is that it's visionary. The mind-forged manacles I hear. I mean, this is a poet who looks at the London streets, and he hears people's imprisonment. I mean, literally hears it. It's audible. That's a kind of amazing notion about seeing the way the culture impacts on people in a way that for most of us is invisible and inaudible.
Mm-hmm.
But here's another line that everybody has heard before: all the world's a stage. It's Shakespeare's line. It usually connotes for people that you go through the phases of life, and that's what I dealt with in my book. But I've also thought further about that line, all the world's a stage. It has to do with the notion of acting. And we think of acting as I'm going to do this. But, of course, if you are a professional actor, it means that you're playing a role.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the notion that the world is a stage rather than just reality, and that what I'm doing is playing a role rather than doing something that's instinctive and organic, is a very disturbing notion in its own way, because I've seen this with people who are depressed, that when you are really clinically depressed, it means things that you have done over and over in your life, which is having a meal, having a conversation, being in love with someone, having a job, going to work. All of a sudden, these things look like constructs. They don't look real to you. They've turned into ghostly forms. So all the world becomes a stage. It's like it's been sort of emptied, like an experiment where you move the oxygen out of things. It's been emptied of its naturalness. And I think Shakespeare points in that direction as well. So those are, you know, those are lines that it seems to me you could unpack forever and realize that, yes, there's something lovely about the world being a set of phases and steps and periods that you go through, but there's also something terrifying about the world being like cardboard. It's just the backdrop.
So I would imagine the role that you're obviously most, you know, that you have been for your 71 years has been that of the, the distiller of literature's wisdom, both to your students and to your readers. Is that accurate? Is that how you feel that what your role is? And if you could reinvent it for in your eighth decade, what kind of a different role could you play? Should you play?
It's a wonderful role. I think the challenge is not to see it as a role, but to see it as the exciting encounter with young people. To the extent that it becomes more and more of something that I rehearse, something that I just deliver, like lines that I've memorized, because after all, I've taught many of these books for decades.
Mm-hmm.
As I become aware of that, and I'm aware of my white hair, and I'm looking at these students in their teens and 20s, I become, you know, uncomfortable with the sense that I'm sort of a puppet standing up there performing. It's much more gratifying when it still has a kind of spontaneity in it, and that it's me talking to them as directly and as sort of unmediated a way as possible. That's what I'm hoping for. I'm hoping that I don't come to see this as so unnatural, as so constructed, that it no longer has the kind of energy and immediacy that, you know, that I want it to have.
You know, when you say you've been teaching these same books for decades, I'm wondering whether a way to ensure that you're not, you know, kind of just replaying old tapes and saying the same things. What, again, this is just a thought experiment. What if in a course you've taught a million times, maybe even Faulkner, which is so close to your heart, when you're teaching Faulkner the next time, instead of doing any lecture on Faulkner, you simply say, read this short story, and then you simply answer questions. So you can't be prepared. You must call on your lifetime of wisdom, perhaps reintegrated in a new way. Would that force you into being out of a role and simply being Arnold Weinstein, aficionado and expert on Faulkner?
Yes, but that, believe it or not, that is exactly what I do. My courses are divided evenly between lecture and discussion. Even if I have 200 students in a course, I have graduate students that help me, and I break it up in discussion groups of some 15 or 20. And in those discussion groups, I sit there often and just to listen to see what, you know, to hear what they're going to say. They're unscripted. I have no idea what topics we're going to move to. I have to have some ideas in the back of my head if they're dead silent. But in general, I feel like that is the kind of, you know, pendulum that moves back and forth in every course that I teach, that I sort of hold forth for 80 minutes in a lecture, and then for 80 minutes 2 days later, they hold forth, or we have back and forth or exchanges, and I never know where they're going, and I never know what they're going to say, and nor do I know what I'm going to say. I mean, in other words, I surprise myself at times when I say something that later sounds really idiotic. I'm not very happy, but sometimes I walk out of there feeling awfully good that if those students hadn't asked those questions or gotten into that issue or gone that direction, I wouldn't know the things that I now have discovered about these materials.
You know, suddenly it just popped into my brain. You know how things are nonlinear? I was thinking about there is a Faulkner, a short novel, and I don't even remember the name of it, but I remember some guy pulling out his mother's casket from the raging waters. Tell us that anecdote, please.
Yes, it's Azale dying, and he wrote it right after The Sound and the Fury. It's one of his most magnificent novels. It's very metaphysical. It's about the efforts of this poor white family, farmers, to get her casket out of the country back to this town where they can bury her. And Faulkner throws everything he can at them, fire and water, so there's a flood they have to cross in their boat, and then the casket goes into the water, and they have to bring it back out. And I think of it as a parable about human beings against forces. You know, we're back to control here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Forces that they cannot control. Faulkner is a great writer in part because he knows exactly what goes on in the mind, which is sound and fury, but he also knows what goes on in the real world where there are things such as tsunamis, you know, and floods and hurricanes and fires, that the natural world is real for Faulkner. It's not just a psychodrama. And his best books pit those two things against each other, and that's maybe the book that does it the best.
I'm looking at the clock. We have just a couple of minutes left. I have one last question. I'm not too stupid, and yet I must admit, and although I'm embarrassed to do so, that I have never sufficiently appreciated literature, despite really trying, and believe me, reading your book morning, noon, and night, and taking your classic novels course on CD from the teaching company are far from my only attempts. For example, I've read Hamlet 3 times, I've watched 2 versions of the movie, I've even read the Cliff Notes, and yet I find myself, if I'm being totally honest, feeling, that's okay, I guess. Now, I read all the time, but I'm always choosing to read practical nonfiction. Are people like me simply missing the aesthetic gene? Or just like I'm missing the gene that would enable me to understand why somebody would, for example, spend $50 on a bottle of wine, like you do, rather than the $5 crap I drink?
Well, I don't think there's an aesthetic gene. I mean, again, I think that art is beautiful, and so there's an aesthetic component. But it's mostly imaginative, and I'm puzzled by that remark, because I think of you as a person who latches on to what is really most interesting and profound in literary materials. That's where literature is special. I mean, when Hamlet, to be or not to be, is more than just okay. You know, some of the language, Shakespeare digs deeper into the pit and reaches further than any other writer in the world. And it seems to me those things always illuminate our own pit, you know, what's going on in our own brains. And I think you pick up a lot more than you are willing to admit from literature. Not the, you know, again, the formal side of it, that's not really so important. It's the perceptual side of it that matters, and I think that writers, you know, really are our guides frequently that way. Not guides into their work, but guides into ourselves.
I suddenly think, you know what it really is? It's about impatience. You know, if I just simply stop to think about to be or not to be, that is the question. And then, of course, but, you know, to whatever, I forgot the rest. But, you know, if I stopped instead of rushing, instead of looking, this is a 300-page book, I got to get through this because I got 10,000 other things to do, but instead savored and thought hard about literature's quintessential lines, maybe I would have appreciated it more.
It's a candidate for the, you know, semester text. You do
Precisely.
One text for 12 weeks.
Anyway, I want to thank you very much, Arnold Weinstein, for what I think, for me, was a very stimulating hour. I hope it was worth it for you and certainly for my listeners. The book is Morning, Noon, and Night, Pulitzer Prize nominee just announced, Finding the Meaning of Life in All Stages of Life Through Literature. I encourage you to buy it. Also, you know, if you do, especially if you spend a lot of time in the car or while you're jogging or walking, the teaching company has got a wealth of great courses that can really edify and entertain, and certainly Arnold Weinstein's are nearly at the top of the list. The one I took is called Classic Novels. I could not more strongly commend it to you. And Arnold, again, thanks for giving me part of your Sunday.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
You be well.
Take care.
And that is Work with Marty Nemko for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Debbie Kennedy. And, of course, to all of you for listening, I apologize for not having done 3-minute career makeovers, but I just make decisions about what I think is ultimately best for all listeners. Next week, I promise, I will be doing 3-minute career makeovers on callers with the able help of my wife, Barbara Nemko. And in addition, we're going to discuss diets. It's not something we normally talk about on a work show, but in this very terrible job market, to be hired these days, it really helps that you not only be good, but look good, so we'll talk a little bit about that. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.
More than 500 of Marty Nemko's published articles and chapters from his book, Cool Careers for Dummies, are free on his website. From there, you also can email him if you'd like coaching on your career or want to comment on this program. His site, martynemko.com. That's martynemko.com. And you can join Marty again next Sunday morning at 11 for Work with Marty Nemko here on 91.7 KLW San Francisco.